Tony Hendra is a writer who's often known for his bite in satiric and comedic stories and films. He was part of the Cambridge University group of players, along with John Cleese and Graham Chapman, who sharpened satire in the 1960s. He was an original editor of the raucous and bawdy National Lampoon. He played Ian Faith in the mock rockumentary This is Spinal Tap. He was the editor of the sharp and sometimes wicked spy magazine. But Tony Hendra has now written a book that's romantic and tender. It is a love story about a boy who becomes a man through the selfless love of a Benedictine monk, Father Joe. The book is Father Joe, The Man Who Saved My Soul, and Tony Hendra joins us from New York. Thanks so much for being with us.
It's a pleasure.
You and Father Joseph Worrallow had what I guess they would call in the movies a cute meet. You were 14 years old. Let me get you to tell the story.
Well, I was 14 years old, as you say, and I was actually having an affair with a married Catholic woman. It wasn't much of an affair, but she was a very devout Catholic, actually, and her husband was an even more devout Catholic. Being a convert, he was more Catholic than the Pope, even. And he decided, rather than shooting me or running me over or something, that I should go on spiritual retreat to a monastery. And I was not in a very good position to do anything about this, having been basically found with my hand down his wife's dress, and the only other option was that they would tell my parents. So I agreed to this, but I was indeed terrified, because the only experience I had of the Catholic clergy up to that point was, let's say, draconian. But when I got to the monastery and met this character, I was extraordinarily surprised. On the one hand, he was very funny-looking. He was he was almost a cartoon of a monk. He had a big groundhog nose and enormous ears, sort of wings of gristle. And you really almost couldn't restrain a laugh when you first saw him, but there was an enormous stillness about the man. It was as if peace came off him, sort of like aftershave, you know. It was so tangible. And I was completely captivated, and he solved this little love triangle by making me fall in love with him.
I guess, like the truly great teachers, he didn't give you a prescription so much as he pointed you in a direction. And in this case, he made you see the woman with whom you were trying to become involved more deeply, making you see her in a different light.
Yes, he said, you haven't done anything truly wrong, Tony. He had this kind of stuttery way of talking. The only sin you've committed is the sin of selfishness. And I realized at that point that, yes, that was a sin. That was much more of a sin than the sex that I'd almost had, because I had exploited, really, this poor, lonely, trapped woman. And that was selfish. And that, to Father Joe, as I grew to know him better and returned to him over a rather apostate life, that really turned out to be his central theme.
He was this monk living on the Isle of Wight in an abbey. What brought you back to him, particularly as you began to move in the outer world on the theater stages of London and New York?
Well, to some degree, it was selfish. I mean, whenever I went through a crisis, which I did quite frequently, he would be my first port of call. I mean, on one occasion, I had gone back to England to do a satirical show there called Spitting Image, which was a wonderful show, actually, in which these two puppeteers built enormous caricature puppets of the great and not so great, and then we wrote sketches in which they did outrageous things. It was really some of the best satire I'd ever been involved with. But I had great problems with the other people, and I was going through a midlife crisis anyway. And Father Joe, who had never seen television, never been to a movie, never had a driving license, probably, you know, never even thought about satire or anything like that, somehow understood not only what I did for a living, but what it had done to me.
I want to get you to recount for us a conversation you okay. once had with him about the nature of satire.
Can I read it from
yes,
my book?
Yes, that was the idea. Sorry. Yeah.
Okay. I will have to approximate Father Joe. Tony, dear, you never told me much about satire. How does it work? Good question. First of all, it's cruel and unfair. It hurts people, and it's supposed to. You take on the colouring of your target's thoughts and beliefs and exaggerate them mercilessly. But you can't just do it arbitrarily, without knowing them. You have to be inside his skin. Or in the case of Maggie Thatcher, her hide. Good heavens, it sounds horrible. It's not a pretty business. He walked thoughtfully for a dozen paces, much twitching of lips and eyebrows, setting earlobes aflutter. Tony, dear, by inside Mrs. Thatcher's, hide, do you mean that you're thinking the way she does? Part of you is yes. And that would be the unpleasant or unkind side of her? The side you want to criticize with your satire? Absolutely. So that would mean you have an unpleasant or unkind side, too? Well, no, not necessarily. How had we got here so fast? I was supposed to be the expert.
Well said, Father Joe. Well said.
Really?
Well said. There's another important lesson, I think, for life that you account once in the book that you learned from improvisation.
Yes. Well, in this case, the sort of proximate show business cause, if you like, was Spinal Tap. Mm-hmm. And Spinal Tap, as you probably know, was completely improvised in the good old tradition of Second City. And I had never done this before, and I was terrified going into this experience that I would be required to actually improvise in front of a camera. So I had some people to talk to about this terrifying prospect, and everybody who I spoke to said, it's really very simple. What you have to do, and it's the only basic rule, is listen to what's being said in front of the camera, and answer only to what you hear. It sounds terribly simple, but it's not only very difficult to do, but when you do it successfully, it has the most extraordinary effect, because you really do find yourself taken into places you've never been before. Mm-hmm. I then remembered that years and years before, Father Joe had said something very similar, which was that the first act of love is listening, really listening to what the other person is saying. And the conscious effort to do that, to reach over those walls into that other person's prison of self, that's love. So in a way, the idea of listening was all part and parcel of this very simple but profound approach he had to people.
What was it like to be working at a place where, I gather from the histories I've read, it could be a raucous office environment like National Lampoon, or on set of something like Spinal Tap, and then be walking around with a letter from a Benedictine monk on the Isle of Wight, and be preparing to write one in return?
I mean, it was tremendously exciting. There's no point in Gade saying that. I've never had much taste for sinners who, you know, dump on everything they've done all their lives. It was hugely exciting, both those things were. But what it wasn't ultimately was enormously fulfilling. And because of my experience of Joe, there was always this other part of me that was never quite fulfilled. And I always remember when I got a letter from him, he had this kind of old-fashioned spidery handwriting. Mm-hmm. And whenever I saw that letter, it was like getting some message from an old group of friends, not just from one friend, but from a group of friends that you would be safe with. And, you know, you wouldn't have to sort of jump-start them into laughter with brilliance, or whatever it was that we did to make people laugh.
When you see stories today about priestly abuse, is there any kind of conflict within you between the satirist and humorist that, to be fair, sees potential and even justice, and the part of you that knows Father Joe and that community of monks and abbots?
Well, I don't know that I would find it very easy to know how to satirize this particular thing. I mean, I find it harder and harder to satirize things anyway because they seem to be getting beyond satire. Mm-hmm. But on the other hand, you know, I had a relationship with a priest, and we were certainly in many intimate situations in purely physical sense of being alone together in all kinds of places, and nothing ever passed between us except wisdom. And to a great degree, I do think that that's a part also of the Catholic tradition. You know, the other thing, too, though, is that Father Joe had this very interesting sense of the laity as opposed to the hierarchy. Mm-hmm. I mean, one of the great sort of discoveries of my journey with him was that while I always thought that I might have a vocation as a monk, if things really got hot and awful, I could always run back to the monastery, you know, and I'd be safe. And he disabused me of that idea and said, you never were a monk. You never had a vocation as a monk. Your vocation was as a husband and a father, and you must accept that. It's just as sacred a vocation as mine. And he said, you know, not nearly enough husbands and wives have been canonized, my dear. which I thought was brilliant, you know, because it is a mark of the hierarchy that allowed this awful abuse to happen and continues to me, make dreadful mistakes, that they only canonize one another.
A few years ago, when Father Joe's health began to fail, you made a point of bringing your son Sebastian to the Isle of Wight to meet him.
My middle son Sebastian and I went to visit Joe in the late winter of 1998, and I'd had a letter from Father Joe about a week earlier than that, in which he was his usual kind of chatty self. He was 89 by now, and his spidery handwriting was getting even more insectoid, but he seemed he seemed perfectly fine. And he had had at a previous time in his life, about 10 years earlier, he'd had a very odd form of cancer of the sinus, which puts a tremendous pressure apparently on the eyes, but he'd beaten it. But when we went through the door, one of his eyes was coming out of his head almost, and I realized that the cancer had returned, and that if he was still in the monastery, not in a hospital, he was going to die. And I was at that point enormously grateful to whatever chance makes us do these things that I had brought Sebastian to see him. Because when he gave Sebastian a hug and kissed him, the look on his face was like a window into heaven. It really was extraordinary. And he said, I've had a visit from an angel, my dear. Anyway, that was the last time I saw Father Joe.
Thank you very much.
Thank you, Scott.
Tony Hendra, joining us from New York. His book is Father Joe, The Man Who Saved My Soul. In totally different mood.
Yes.
A detour. I found no other place for it in the conversation. Could you remind us, what was it like to go to grade school with Stephen Hawking? let me put it this way. How humbling was that?
Well, it should have been very humbling, especially in the light of what happened subsequently. But it wasn't at the time. This was when I was 11, 12, and 13. For those 3 years, I sat right behind Stephen Hawking. The roll call went Hall, Hawking, Hendra. And the great utility of Hawking to his classmates, especially the thuggier element like me, was that he could do our math homework at the speed of light, and which we duly made him do under threat of physical coercion.
You got very good grades in mathematics then.
Very good grades in homework, but not in spot tests.